Welcome to this talk. I'm Dr. Barbara Stone, speaking about history according to the Sumerian tablets. This information is in my book, Transforming Fear into Gold, and much of it is drawn from the many books of Zachariah Sitchin, a scholar who researched the Sumerian tablets. These are a series of over 500,000 clay tablets written in cuneiform that have come from the civilization that is the very first one on our planet to leave a written history, the Sumerians. And the tablets were found in the area of Iraq, which is the site of ancient Sumer. They tell a story that is congruent with the story presented in the Old Testament, but also gives a much fuller background as to how humans were created, why they were created, and why they have some of the problems that they do. One of the reasons I love studying this material is because it brings me a profound hope for the evolution of our species. By seeing how we were imprinted with some dysfunctional emotional patterns, we can break out of these, we can see the truth and expand into our full human potential. I grew up in a Christian home, and as a teenager, I read the entire Bible through several times, from the beginning to the end. I was puzzled by a great contradiction I saw. The New Testament told me that God loved me, that God cherished me, but in the Old Testament, the Lord got very angry with his people. He created them, but then they were so sinful that he gave them pestilence, plagues, and would strike them dead with the sword. And then he got so fed up with them all that he planned to kill all of them with the flood. I asked my mother, why was God so mean in the Old Testament? She explained the situation to me in humorous terms. She said, well, God wasn't a Christian yet. Now, as a grown-up, I'm thinking, scientists tell us the universe is about 14 to 18 billion years old, and that the formation of our solar system happened only about 4.5 billion years ago. So I'm asking myself, does this really make sense that a creator who's had the universe for all of these billions of years suddenly only 2,000 years ago changes his mind about the attitude toward the humans he created? It didn't quite make sense to me. The story the tablets tell is pretty wild. It talks about ancient astronauts coming to the planet Earth to mine gold, and then gene splicing some primitive workers to help them mine the gold, cloning their creation. And these are things that hundreds of years ago humans would have laughed at because they were not things that we could conceive of as happening. But we now have space travel, we have the ability to gene splice things, and we have the ability to clone. So let's take a look at what the tablets say and decide for yourself if it makes more sense than the story that we might have been told growing up. Maybe there's a reason that scholars didn't figure out how to break the code to translate cuneiform until just during these last 100 years. The tablets say some things that scientists back up as being actually true about the formation of our solar system. The tablets say that as the planets were forming around our sun 4.5 billion years ago, there was a very large planet that was orbiting between Jupiter and Mars. The name of this planet was Tiamat, and Tiamat was so big that she was making the orbits of the other planets unstable. Somewhere a call for help went out, and there was another planet that was passing by that had come in from deep outer space, and it got captured in the magnetic field of our sun, drawn into our solar system, but passing around the sun the opposite direction. This planet that was drawn in is called Nibiru, and Nibiru was set on a collision course with Tiamat to subdue her. Nibiru smashed into Tiamat and cleaved her in half. One half of Tiamat was drawn closer to the sun and went into orbit on the other side of Mars. It became the planet that we're living on right now, the planet Earth. One thing that convinced me this could be true was simply looking at a globe. From the half of the Earth where the Pacific Ocean is, one sees mostly water, and the other half of the planet is mostly land, and one can see how the continents seem to be like a giant jigsaw puzzle that used to fit together and then kind of spread apart. Another factor that points to the veracity of this story is the size of our moon. Actually, our moon is too big for our planet. All the other planets have much smaller moons. The records say that Tiamat had a satellite orbiting her that was destined to become a planet in its own right with its own orbit. But this satellite came with the part of Tiamat that split off and became our moon. If you look in the sky, our moon looks about as big as the sun, and it's not that way on other planets. On a subsequent pass around our sun, Nibiru smashed the other half of Tiamat into the asteroid belt. Now we go back to looking at life on Nibiru. A war had developed in ancient times on Nibiru, a war over resources, and it escalated to a world war for them between the North and the South. The weapons escalated to use of nuclear warfare. Finally, they made a peace plan with a queen from one side and a king from the other to rebuild their planet. The succession for the king went to the firstborn son, and all was well for a time, but then Nibiru developed another problem, which was a political struggle over who would be the next king. The war had killed so many of the men that men were in short supply, so Nibiru passed a law that a man could have as many women as he chose, but he could only marry one of them. As time went on, one of the queens had an idea because her son was not the firstborn son of the king, and the king would marry his sister because that would keep his son a more purely genetic copy of the king. So they changed the succession rule. This caused a problem because with the king that was in charge during the time when the astronauts came to Earth, his firstborn son was named Enki, and he loved Enki, his firstborn son, but his son had been born to a concubine rather than his wife. Later, his wife bore a son Enlil, and Enlil had claim to the throne. In the meantime, as time went on, Nibiru developed some atmospheric problems. There was a breach in her atmosphere. So every time she came close to the sun, it got very, very hot. And in the time of her orbit, when she was away from the sun, things got very cold. The orbit of Nibiru was very long. It was 3,600 years and corresponds almost exactly to the orbit of the comet Hale-Bopp, which has a 4,000-year cycle around the sun, and the cycle is elliptical, just like the circuit of Nibiru. Well, with the weather disrupted, the rains didn't come, the winds blew, the crops failed, and there was a food shortage on Nibiru. This sounds like the problems our planet is having now with the hole in our ozone layer. The people on Nibiru are called the Nephilim in the Bible. In the Sumerian records, they are called the Anunnaki in Akkadian, and I will use the term Anunnaki in this talk as that is the term that Sitchin uses most often in his work. They tried powdering metal and throwing it up into the sky to fill in that hole in their atmosphere. They tried copper, but it was so heavy it just fell right back down to the ground. The only metal they found that would stay in suspension was gold, because gold has a very special quality that when you heat it to break apart the 19 atoms that are bonded together in solid gold, gold in its monatomic form is lighter than air, so gold would stay in suspension. The only problem was Nibiru had hardly any gold. The only planet in our solar system that had been well endowed with gold was Tiamat, and they could see in the asteroid belt that there was lots of gold in the half of Tiamat that had been shattered. So they sent some spaceships over to try to get that gold, but the spaceships never returned. They got all banged up by the chaos of that asteroid belt. The Anunnaki then sent an expedition to the Earth to see if they could get gold from the seawater, and that did yield gold. However, it wasn't quite enough to use in the quantities that they needed. The king on Nibiru was named Anu, and he had sent his firstborn son Enki to be in charge of this project on the Earth. After a time, Anu came to visit the space mission and brought his son Enlil with him. Anu decided that they needed to change from trying to get the gold out of the water to mining it directly from the earth. At that point, Enlil was put in charge of the Earth mission. He was made Supreme Commander on Earth and called Lord Enlil, and Enki was put in charge of mining the gold. Actually, it was a better match because Enki was a brilliant scientist and devised all kinds of tools to get the gold from the Earth. Everything went well for many orbits of Nibiru around our Sun. In fact, for about 144,000 years, the gold mining went well. But as time went on, the Earth moved into a period of global warming, and the work in the mines became more and more difficult. The miners went on strike. They said, "We are not going to do this anymore. We hate this job." They burned their tools, and they mutinied, and they surrounded Enlil's house and said, "Let's kill Enlil." What were they to do? If they didn't get the gold, their planet would die, but nobody wanted to do the gold mining job. Enlil's brother Enki came to him and said, "I have an idea for a win-win solution that could solve everything." Enki had been studying the wildlife in South Africa, where the main focus of the gold mining was, and he was fascinated with a certain creature that walked upright. It was probably Homo erectus. And Enki suggested to the council, "Perhaps we could just gene splice some of our brains into this primitive creature and make a worker willing to mine gold in return for food." Enlil, the ruler, said, "Absolutely not. It is forbidden under galactic law to go to a planet and interfere with the genetic line there." He said slavery was abolished on Nibiru a long time ago. Well, that had to go to the High Council of Nibiru to decide what to do. The debate was long and hard. Some of the wise beings said we should just accept our fate and let our planet die and all of our race become extinct. But others said, "Why would the Creator have given us such high intelligence if we weren't meant to use it?" That's an argument that we hear sometimes in the genetic research that's going on in our planet today. In the end, the Council decided to violate cosmic law and create a slave race because they would all die if they didn't. Enki and his sister Ninma set out to try and see how they could get a new worker. The first idea they had was to have an Anunnaki male impregnate a Homo erectus female. But that didn't work. The genes were not similar enough to mate. So then they started gene splicing some Anunnaki genes into the egg of a Homo erectus female. And some of the ones that they created had defects, like one couldn't hear, one couldn't see, one the liver didn't work, on another the semen dripped out, on another the arms were too short to reach the mouth, which was quite a severe design problem. But in the end, NINMA mapped the whole genome and figured out for Homo erectus what went with what so that they created a model that would work well. It took them about 10,000 years to get everything figured out. Another design improvement they made was they figured out that instead of mixing the genes in a crystal from Nibiru, they needed to mix it in a clay bowl because the clay would have some of the elements of the earth that their creation needed. And one further design improvement was instead of gestating the fetus in the womb of a Homo erectus, they decided to gestate it in the womb of an Anunnaki woman, and NINMA volunteered. She had a male that was perfect, and she called him the Adamu. This creature couldn't speak, but it could understand speech and take orders. They then cloned 7 more from the Adamu, and then they realized they would need a female template too. So they created a female template, and Enki's wife incubated that one. They cloned 7 more females and let those 7 pairs mate. However, they noticed that no babies were coming from those unions. Enki and his son went back to the drawing board to figure out what was wrong. His son noticed that these creatures had only 22 pairs of chromosomes, and they would need to have one more to make 23 if they were to become fertile. Enki's son did what sounds like a bone marrow transplant. He put NINMA, Enki's sister, and Enki to sleep, and he put the Adamu and the female model, who was called Tiamat, he put them to sleep, and he took from the essence of Enki's rib and put it into the Adamu. He took from the essence of Ninma's rib and put it into Tiamat. And then their template was upgraded, and they had awareness of sexuality, and they could mate. They were fertile. This precious template pair had been taken to Enlil's area, which was called the Aedin, and set to work in Enlil's orchard. Well, when Enlil came home one day and was walking in his orchard, he saw that his workers were wearing fig aprons, and he asked Enki, "What's going on with these two?" Enki explained the problem that they needed many more workers than the Anunnaki females could incubate because there were hardly any Anunnaki women on the expedition, and he told how he had upgraded their genetic template to make them smarter, more aware, and fertile. Enlil almost blew his stack. He was furious with his brother. He said, "They're going to multiply and take over this whole planet." He said, "Next you're going to give them the extended lifespans we have, because the Anunnaki lived about 500,000 years. Their DNA was pretty well perfect." But Enki said, no, "I've not given them the longevity that we have, just the fertility." Well, Enlil was still so angry he threw them out of his garden. And we hear in this story many parallels to the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. The primitive workers turned out to be very good for their job, and Anunnaki gold production was able to resume, and the gold mining was highly successful. According to Sitchin's timeline, the Anunnaki came to Earth approximately 450,000 years ago, and the mutiny happened about 300,000 BC. The primitive workers finally got perfected about 290,000 BC, And all went well for a couple hundred thousand years. But over time, with successive reproductions, the genetic lines regressed back more to their primitive origins. Enki was trying to figure out how could he upgrade the humans. One day he was down by the river watching two wildly beautiful earthling females bathing naked, and he got an idea. He got an erection, and he impregnated both of these females. He didn't know at that point whether the genes could cross and support a viable fetus, but to his delight, both of these earthlings gave birth to a child. One was male, one was female. Enki named the children Adipa and Titi, and he and his wife protected and raised and taught these two beings, and to their utter delight, these two children could talk. They were the first primitive workers that could talk, and they were called civilized humans. Enki's father wanted to see one of these new creatures, so Adipa was taken on a rocket ship ride to Nibiru for King Anu to approve of. King Anu was very pleased with this civilized human and gave his blessing. Adipa and Titi mated and gave birth to twins, Cain and Abael, called Cain and Abel in the biblical account. Enki's son Marduk taught Abael how to shepherd, and Enlil's son Ninurta taught Cain how to grow crops. When the first harvest came, Enlil praised both brothers. Enki only praised Abael, the one his son had taught, and Cain's feelings were hurt. In Zechariah Sitchin's account in the Lost Book of Enki, Abael taunted his brother that his sheep were more important to feed the Anunnaki men than Cain's crops. Tension built between the two brothers. When drought came and Abael watered his flocks in the irrigation ditches Cain had dug for his fields, the brothers got into a heated argument. Cain hit his brother in the head with a stone over and over. Then, when Cain realized he had killed his brother, he wept. Cain was exiled as punishment and sent to the land across the waters. God put a mark of protection on him by genetically adjusting his DNA so he would not grow facial hair. The indigenous people of North and South America do not grow facial hair, and some speculate that they are the descendants of Cain. Just as rivalry between the brothers Enlil and Enki caused friction, this pattern of sibling rivalry carried down into the offspring of the first two civilized humans. We still have this pattern of strife between the nations that came from Abraham's two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. Ishmael was Abraham's son from a concubine, the firstborn, and Isaac was his son by his wife. Ishmael's descendants are the Arab nation, and Isaac's descendants are the Israeli nation, and war has still been going on between them. A new problem developed that made Enlil like the humans even less. Enki's son Marduk announced to his parents that he wanted to get married. Pleased, they asked who was the intended bride. When Marduk told them that the woman he wanted to marry was a human named Sarpanet, they were shocked. Could an Anunnaki marry a human? Nothing was in their rule books about this issue. The problem went to the Council on Nibiru, which decided that he could marry Sarpanet, but Marduk could never bring her to Nibiru, and he had to give up all claim to the throne on Nibiru. Marduk agreed, and a big wedding celebration was planned. Marduk had been in charge on Mars, where 300 Anunnaki, called Igigi, built a space base to collect the gold that was gathered during each 3,600-year cycle and to have it ready for the big pickup every time Nibiru came close to the Earth. Life on Mars was difficult, and no women were there. The Earth also had very few Anunnaki women. The only females who came to Nibiru were a few wives, and Ninma, the chief medical officer and sister of Enlil and Enki, who came with a handful of female nurses. She had borne a couple of daughters by Enki and offered any of her daughters to Marduk as a bride, but he wanted the human. Secretly, 200 Igigi plotted to get women for themselves, too. They came down to Earth for the wedding, ostensibly to celebrate with their leader, but after the wedding, they each stole a bride and took them back to Mars. Then the Anunnaki on the Earth also wanted women and began to intermarry with the humans. The offspring of these unions were taller than the civilized humans, more intelligent, and lived longer than the average human. They were considered demigods. Genesis talks about this problem in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. I quote from the Bible. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years." The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. Remember that Nephilim is the word that the Bible uses for the Anunnaki. Enlil was furious that his purebred Anunnaki mated with the mortal servants they had created. He wanted to get rid of all the humans. Genesis continues in chapter 6, verses 5 to 7. Then the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, "I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals, and creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them." Then in verse 8, suddenly the Lord changes his mind, and the verse says, "But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." The Sumerian tablets tell a background story that accounts for this sudden change of heart. The Sumerians recorded that the earth was going through climate changes. Crops diminished and not as many new lambs were born. Food was scarce and had to be rationed even for the Anunnaki. During this time, Enki became enthralled with the outstanding beauty of a human woman named Batanash. He sent her husband away to Egypt to study city building and sent Batanash to his sister's house for protection. Enki then visited his sister and impregnated Batanash. The child that was born to Batanash had white skin, blonde hair, and brilliant blue eyes. Since he did not look like her husband, the father-in-law of Batanash demanded to know whether this child was the son of one of the Igigi. Batanash swore upon her life that the boy's father was not one of the Igigi, and she was telling the truth, because Enki was not an Igigi. The Igigi were the ones from Mars. This child was named Ziusudra in the Sumerian records and is called Noah in the Bible. As the weather pattern got worse and food got even more scarce, Enlil was even angrier with the humans for the food they consumed, which left less for the Anunnaki. He plotted how to get rid of them all. Plagues and pestilences afflicted the earth and the humans got sick. Nenma wanted to teach the humans how to cure themselves, but Enlil forbade her. Enki wanted to teach the humans to fish, but Enlil again forbade him. For the next 10,000 years, the suffering of the humans increased. The account of Noah's time in the boat is almost identical in the Sumerian tablets and in Genesis chapter 8, verses 6 to 12. In the Sumerian records, the pilot steered the submarine to Mount Ararat, the tallest place in the area. When Noah and his family landed safely, they sacrificed a sheep in gratitude for safe passage. Shortly thereafter, Enlil and Enki arrived on the other peak of Mount Ararat. When Enlil smelled roasting mutton, he went to investigate. When he found humans still alive, he was so furious, he was ready to strangle Enki with his bare hands. But then King Anu sent word that the close passing of the two planets had ripped open the hole in Nibiru's atmosphere again, and they needed much more gold very quickly. But how were they to produce any more gold? All the primitive workers had died in the flood. All the Anunnaki that ran the gold smelting operation had returned to Nibiru. All the tools had been taken up, and all the gold mines in South Africa were filled with mud. The situation was desperate. Enlil's son Ninurta flew around the planet to assess damages. To his astonishment, he found that across the waters in the area of South America, the heaving of the earth had cut deep veins into the mountains, and gold nuggets were lying all around, available to be gathered without mining. The Anunnaki were overjoyed and, in this moment, gave thanks to the Creator of all for this miracle. Four brothers and sisters in South America, descendants of Cain, had survived the flood on a raft. Their mountaintop was now an island in the midst of Lake Titicaca, a 3,200-square-mile lake on the border between Peru and Bolivia. The Anunnaki set up gold processing facilities in Cusco, Peru, at a place called Sacsayhuaman. I visited this ancient site and was amazed at the giant boulders with multiple faces fitting together perfectly, without even enough space for the blade of a knife to pass between the joints. One carefully hewn stone was 28 feet high and calculated to weigh 361 tons. The Anunnaki resumed gold production, this time in South America, cultivating and teaching the humans there. Many places in South America talk about tall, white-skinned, bearded teachers coming to teach them writing, crafts, and community organization. They called these benevolent beings the Viracocha and were expecting them to return. Another part of the Sumerian record sheds light on the problem of land ownership in the area of Israel. After the flood, King Anu divided the earth into four sections. 1. The Sinai Peninsula, the site of their spaceport, was a neutral zone given to Ninma and was off limits to the earthlings. 2. The area of the Middle East was given to Enlil and his offspring and to Noah's sons Shem and Japheth. 3. Africa was given to Enki's family and also Noah's middle son named Ham. 4. Enlil's granddaughter Inanna was granted dominion in the valley around the Indus River, now the countries of Pakistan, northwest India, and eastern Afghanistan. As Ham was passing through the Middle East on his way from Turkey to his assigned land in Africa, he liked the area and decided to squat there. Others warned Ham that he could bring a curse upon himself and his offspring, as the land was promised to Enlil, but Ham did not listen. Ham had four sons, and one of them named Cana settled in the area that is now the country of Israel. Thousands of years later, Enlil raised an army by freeing his people from slavery in Egypt, leading them out with Moses and taking back this land promised to him. He instructed Joshua, the leader of the Israelites, to kill every man, woman, child, and animal in the country. Ham did bring hardship upon his descendants by taking what did not belong to him. The flood happened around 10,800 BC. The Anunnaki then set to work digging out the cities, rebuilding, and repopulating the humans. They set up a system of priest kings to govern the people. They made the king special by mating a human and an Anunnaki, so the king was taller than the average person he governed. One of the hallmarks of the king's claim to power came from his being a son of God. The Anunnaki instructed the priest kings what to tell the humans to do. When Nibiru passed by the earth for the second time since the flood, about 3800 BC, King Anu and Queen Antu came to earth for a state visit. The Anunnaki built a special city, Erech, for the king, and had a great celebration. After the festivities, Enlil, Enki, and their sister Ninma sat down to have a long talk with their parents, who noticed that the children looked older than they did. Being on earth for hundreds of thousands of years, with its shorter cycles, had aged them. Enki reminisced about how Anu had sent Galzu to advise them to stay because they would die soon if they had returned to Nibiru. Anu said he did not know anyone by the name of Galzu and had not sent him. Anu said that returning to Nibiru was a big adjustment, but it could be cured with elixirs. The whole family sat around and marveled, wondering who Galzu was. Eventually, they realized that something beyond themselves had intervened to save the humans with the submersible boat. Perhaps the great creator of all had compassion on the human race and sent an angel in the form of an Anunnaki wise man, Galzu, to trick the children into staying, saving the DNA samples and the seeds, and rebuilding on the earth. Galzu intervened in Anunnaki politics again and came to Enlil in a dream, telling him that Marduk, his brother Enki's firstborn son, would rise to supremacy in the age of the ram, which would begin around 2000 BC. Marduk knew also about this prophecy and carefully watched the sky to see when the constellation of the ram would arise on the spring equinox. Enlil realized he was going to lose his control of Earth and wanted to develop a group of humans loyal to him as a hedge against losing all his power. He chose the son of the high priest in his home city, a young man named Abram, and tested his allegiance by asking him to sacrifice his only legitimate heir, Isaac. Abram, later renamed Abraham, knew that Enlil was a lot taller than he was and had superpowers. Abraham was willing to do whatever Enlil told him to do, including sacrificing Isaac as a burnt offering to Enlil, so he passed the loyalty test. Enlil rewarded Abraham with livestock and land, and his offspring multiplied. Marduk was popular with the humans, especially since he had married a human. As 2000 BC approached, Marduk built an alternate space launching tower in Babylon, called the Tower of Babel in the Bible. Enlil was very displeased and stopped the plan by confounding the languages of the humans. In 2024 BC, Marduk marched on Sumer and enthroned himself in Babylon, right in the middle of Enlil's territory. Marduk and his son Nabu were about to seize control of the Anunnaki spaceport on the Sinai Peninsula. Alarmed by the imminent takeover, Enlil called a council to ask for permission to intervene in Marduk's military advances. Enki objected, saying it was time for Marduk to rule. Others would not listen to Enki, and the council gave permission to drop nuclear bombs on the cities where they thought Marduk and Nabu were hiding, Sodom and Gomorrah, and on the spaceport itself to prevent Marduk from getting control of it. The fallout from those nuclear bombs caused a windstorm that spread nuclear radiation all over Sumer, killing all the animals, humans, and plants in the area. Sumer was a wasteland which hastened Marduk's march to power. When Marduk was enthroned at last in Babylon, he seems to have been infected by a dark force entity of lusting for more and more power, never being satisfied with what he had. He rewrote Anunnaki history, renaming Nibiru Marduk and saying that he was the creator of the entire universe. He usurped the attributes of all the other gods and decreed hymns to call him by aggrandizing names. The other Anunnaki gods did not like Marduk's unwillingness to share power with others. Even his father Enki felt Marduk had gone too far. Marduk's inflation drew a curse upon himself that he would wither and die. Babylon was captured by the king of Persia in 539 BC. Disillusioned, Marduk withered, became confused, and died. According to Sitchin, Enlil became so fed up with the humans that when Nibiru came close again, around 600 BC, Enlil led a mass exodus of the Anunnaki gods, leaving their temples, getting into their spaceships, and going back to Nibiru. The humans felt desolate, abandoned by their gods. They longed for a messiah to save them. As I was writing about the interface of the Anunnaki with humans, I found myself getting really angry at all the gold the Anunnaki had robbed from the planet Earth. But then I realized that if the Anunnaki had never developed a breach in their atmosphere by using nuclear weapons on Nibiru, they would never have come to Earth and gene-spliced Homo sapiens. Nibiru would still have passed close to the Earth in 10,800 BC, and the flood would still have happened, and all of the two-leggeds and four-leggeds on the planet would have perished in the flood. Most of the plant life would be gone, and perhaps only a few sea creatures would have survived the disaster. Evolution would have been set back by billions of years. Our race would never have been created, and we would not be here now taking part in the evolutionary shift of the ages in this monumental 26-year time in history that began with December 21st, 2012, and will end in 2038 as we all shift into a higher level of awareness for all beings on this beautiful planet Earth.